Today on Principles and Policies, the Federal Follies. Next. Welcome to this weekend edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our Vice Chairman, my co-host, regular co-host, good friend and fellow commiserator over all things federal, Chuck Michaelis.
Yes, well, it looks today like we're going to do sort of a federal Keystone Cops. hand over federal authority and then watch them poke each other in the eye.
You know, you're right. But, you know, Chuck, I haven't decided yet whether or not to go from the most ludicrous to the most serious or the most serious to the most ludicrous. Because today, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be discussing a lot of things that have been happening recently at the federal level, actions that are being taken by your federal government that at the very least stretch credulity, at the very most, is, as Chuck mentioned, a Keystone Cop kind of move. If you hear that I have excitement in my voice, it's because I really like doing this. I really like pointing out where our federal government, this is how they actually work, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, I'm sorry to say it, but, you know, if we all think that it's all a number of statesmen who are sitting there and they have the good of the country in mind and they're sacrificing and they're struggling over the how to word a particular piece of legislation so that it will do the most good for the most number of people in the country, well, I think what we're going to be talking about today might dispel most of that notion. So I guess let's start with the one that probably was the most absurd, and since the absurdity has been noted, has been withdrawn by the federal government, and that is taxing Christmas trees. Yes, that's right, ladies and gentlemen. Your federal government, through the Obama administration, had decided to put a tax on the Scotch pines and the Norway spruces and the Douglas firs of the world that many people go out either, and this is mainly not for the ones for those of us who live in farm country where we can just trot back on the hill with an axe or a chainsaw and cut one down ourselves if we feel like off our own property and put it up there and put all the garlands and ribbons and ornaments on. But for those of you who, say, go to the tree farms, the nurseries, the roadside stands, the fresh fruit and vegetable stands that convert into tree outlets during this holiday season, for you, you are going to get a tax on your fresh-cut live Christmas tree, courtesy of the Obama administration. Now, Chuck, I don't know about you. I really don't do trees, whether they're real or artificial. But I could see where this could end up generating quite a bit of money, because there are probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Christmas trees that are cut and sold every year in this country.
Well, the funny thing about this was that the purpose was supposedly to raise funds. Now, again, well, let's get what the real meaning of to raise funds is.
Yes.
It means to raise money for corporate welfare. because that's exactly what it was. It was supposedly go back to the large farmers so they could, quote unquote, market Christmas trees. Well, I mean, who came up with this, Larry, Curly, or Moe? Because probably Curly, since he had the least brains of the three. I think that market is already pretty well set, and you're pretty sure that you're not going to be selling any Easter trees. You're going to be selling Christmas trees sometime between generally mid-November to about mid-December.
Now, Chuck, I'm going to press you on that one a little bit, because it seems to me that every year it's earlier and earlier and earlier. I'm actually expecting Christmas items to be shown up in most retail outlets on July the 5th here pretty soon. Yeah. Because it seems like because the commercialization of Christmas, and ladies and gentlemen, if you're listening to us, you understand that, you know, we're making light of this. But Christmas is not something to make light of, because it is an acknowledgement and a celebration of the birth of the Savior, Jesus Christ. It's not necessarily about a tree or about presents, even though our contemporary society has made it mostly that way, because, my goodness, you can't even say the word Christmas in some places anymore without offending somebody, because the word Christ happens to be at the front end of it, you know, Christ Mass. That's where it comes from. That's where the word Christmas comes from, is the Mass of Christ. It's a Roman Catholic tradition, early Roman Catholic tradition to start with. But It's based upon the fact that our Savior was born in Bethlehem to the Virgin Mary, as the God had declared for the sins of the world to be washed with his blood. So we shouldn't forget that part of it. But, you know, as we've gone now into our modern society, really, a lot of times, it's about the tree. So I don't know, Chuck, if it's going to be mid-November and on. I mean, you may stand up, start seeing people selling fresh-cut Christmas trees sometime around Labor Day if it keeps up.
Well, here's the deal. Most fresh-cut Christmas trees are cut by October.
Yes.
Now, if you go too early, let's say that you decide to beat the rush and buy your fresh cut tree in September or October, there's not going to be too many needles left on it by December 25th, let alone, you know, when I was a kid, my mom always left the tree up for the 12 days of Christmas. So it was in January sometime, I forget when, mm-hmm. January sometime when we finally took it down. Well, you cut a tree in September and put it up, even if you feed it, if you water it and do all the stuff you're supposed to, you're basically going to have a giant log with the branches still on it by, you know, January the 5th or whatever the date is.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be looking good. So you normally sell them mid-November to mid-January.
Okay.
And anybody who waits till Christmas Eve to buy a Christmas tree, which my parents did once, you take what you get.
That's that Charlie Brown Christmas tree that we see in the Christmas special. It has about four branches. Stands about a foot and a half tall, has four branches on it, and three of them are broken. Yeah, I understand what you're talking about. But, you know, Chuck,
As a sidebar, my father owned a hearse, and we'd pick the Christmas tree up in the hearse.
Oh, well, you know, that fresh-cut live Christmas tree isn't going to be live very much longer, so that may have been fitting.
Yeah, that's yes. Did I have a bizarre childhood? In many ways, yes.
Yeah.
Which gave me a strong sense of irony, so I could recognize the nonsense that goes on in the federal government. And again, I have to laugh because this great tax on Christmas trees was going to raise money to market them. I'm like, well, who are you going to market them to?
Let's delve into that for our listeners just a little bit more, because, ladies and gentlemen, what they're talking about, the regulation. Now, first of all, the Department of Agriculture backed off on this, and they have indefinitely suspended, their words, not mine, quote unquote. First of all, they put a temporary stay on the in the enactment of this new fee. They called it. See, they didn't call it a tax; they call it a fee. But we all know, if we understand the Constitution, we understand language, that taxes and fees are the same thing. But what they said was, oh, you know, okay, we're going to stay this temporarily. Then a week ago Friday, on the 17th of November, they've now said they're going to, quote unquote, indefinitely stay the enforcement of that regulation in the hopes of providing, it's a quote from the Federal Register, from the Department of Agriculture. They're going to say that, it quote, in order to provide all interested persons, including the Christmas tree industry and the general public, an opportunity to become more familiar with the program, unquote. So in other words, they haven't gotten rid of the tax, even though that's what's being reported, you know, that the Christmas tree tax, you know, they got rid of the Christmas tree tax. No, they haven't. What this tax was a proposed 15 cent per tree fee, okay? Now, most people think, oh, 15 cents, so what are they talking about? Ladies and gentlemen, the Christmas tree industry in the United States, let me use the correct terminology that our federal overseers use. The fee was calculated to raise annually $2 million for the Department of Agriculture. Now, the department supposedly was going to use that to fund, as Chuck said, an ad campaign to promote fresh-cut Christmas trees over the artificial trees. Now, Chuck, again, just the ludicrousness of taxing Christmas trees to start with is something to think about. But, you know, that whole point that, okay, we're going to take the Obama administration's again trying to pick winners and losers. They're trying to promote one industry over another. In other words, what this was going to be was supposedly a stimulus program for the Christmas tree industry.
I think that comes about every November. There's a sudden stimulus of the cut Christmas tree industry. I'm not sure why that works.
Now, understanding. Now, again, like I said, I don't really do trees, and I don't know if you do the if you if you frequent the fresh cut industry or the aluminum industry with your tree. But
well, I'm more like pipe cleaners and plastic tendrils. We've used a very realistic looking artificial tree now for the last 27 years or so.
You're the type of person that's causing the industry to go south, and that's the reason why the Obama administration must step in and pick a winner in this, and they're going to do it by taxing us when we buy our Christmas trees. Now, okay, that really is just incredible, first of all, on the offset, because, you know, honestly, those people say, well, 15 cents, oh, that's not a big deal. But it's the principle behind the thing that, is there nothing that can't be reached by taxation when an agency decides they want to get the government involved in an industry? Now, that's what we're getting down to here.
Well, let's talk for a minute about why they decided to, quote unquote, suspend this tax, because the reasons become obvious when you look at it. What happens in 2012?
Well, other than the fact that there's an election coming up, and the president whose approval ratings are down somewhere in the sub-basement category is probably looking for a little love from some industries, I can't see any reason why that would be important.
You know, this would be a major albatross around his neck when it came time for campaign time. This is the president who taxed Christmas trees.
Oh, even worse, I can see the animated 30-second commercials with Barack Obama's face superimposed over the Grinch's body instead
of the Grinch,
how the Obama Grinch stole Christmas. I can see it happening. So I understand that once they realized what was about to happen here, all of a sudden somebody probably made a phone call and said, you need to put a hold on that right now. Now, what they said, their rationale, because the department always has, a department who does a boneheaded move like this always has to save face. So what did they say?
Yeah.
Well, they stated until the department can better, quote, explain how a research and promotion program is a producer-driven program to support American farmers. Did you catch that, ladies and gentlemen? What they're really saying is we're trying to figure out a way to do the PR spin on this to make it look like it wasn't the government who was doing the tax, that it was the industry who was asking us to tax you. Do you see the shift here? I mean, that's absolutely – now, first of all, let's basically get down to brass tacks here. We know full well that, yes, there are industries who go to the government and ask them to do things to support their industry. I mean, you look at the stimulus plan and the bailout and cash for clunkers. Guaranteed that the new car, the big three automakers were at the table helping make those decisions in order to boost their sagging industry because they were producing products that weren't competitive. Now, if fresh cut Christmas trees, I think honestly will always be competitive because people like, even if you have the artificial tree, the 27-year-old tree that Chuck has, or you get the potpourri smell of pine cones and other things that you can put in a little pot near your plastic tree, it's still not the same to most people as having that Douglas fir, or that Scotch pine, or that Norwegian spruce propped up there in the family room, with the top of the thing and the star almost brushing the ceilings of the house, and having that smell, and yes, even the pine needles to clean up off the carpet or the linoleum floor. And just there's just that traditional feel about it that many people flock to every year. And even though sometimes, I think, Chuck, maybe I'm making a stereotype here, but I think probably a lot of young couples who maybe are getting into their first home, my guess is that's probably a good market for the natural Christmas tree industry because, it's that setting up of a tradition type thing.
One of the things a lot of people are doing, especially if they have a large backyard these days, is buying a bald Christmas tree so they can plant it when Christmas is over. Now, the reason I keep an artificial is my wife has a mold allergy and has had for years. And I love the smell and the whole thing. I don't mind watering them. I don't mind cleaning up the needles. I love a good, live, great big Christmas tree, but we just can't do it in our house. So, this whole idea that they're going to market more. When, for instance, when I was a kid, we had 10-foot ceilings in a house. Well, that means you buy a 9-foot Christmas tree. Do you know what a 9-foot cut Christmas tree costs about right now?
Probably about $60 to $80.
I'd say it's more than that.
Oh, it could be more than that. Now, and Chuck, man, you and I are on the same page today, even though we're in separate locations, because that's the whole point. See, as I mentioned, and you're right, the prices are very expensive, and maybe that's part of the reason why the Christmas tree industry is having a little trouble and needs a marketing campaign. And as a matter of fact, their association, the National Christmas Tree Association, yes, ladies and gentlemen, there is a lobbying group called the National Christmas Tree Association. They've been after this fee since 2009 to create a marketing fund so that they can go out, similar to the got beef from the beef cattlemen's industry and the pork producers with their the other white meat. They want to get out there on basically they want to get on TV and they want to promote their product.
Ask yourself a question.
Yeah.
Ask yourself a question. Who would get the money from this fund?
Well, they're saying that the producers are going to get it to market their product.
No, through what venue would the producers get
through the Department of Agriculture, which means the federal government gets the fee, and then they can tell this association and these producers what they can and can't do, because now they control the purse string.
Well, here's another thing that would happen. They will get it through what's known as a non-governmental organization.
That's right.
Because what would happen was the checks would be doled out to this to an industry marketing or a research group, and that research group would be in what is known as an NGO. It's an organization that has deep and strong ties to the government, but isn't really the government.
Like the Federal Reserve.
Well, yes, exactly.
Okay, but we're not going to be talking about that today. So.
Well, that's right. We'll save that for at least a week and an hour. Exactly. I think a whole week and an hour. But that being said, this is the way a government is doing a lot of things. It forms corporations, and then it claims that those corporations are independent entities when in fact they are not. They're under the complete control of the federal government. And what happens at that point is that they gain all kinds of quasi-legal ways of controlling the industry. Now, you and I both know that environmentalism has to be tied in here someplace.
Yes.
That some of this fee is going to go into trying to sell this to environmentalists who think no tree should ever be cut for any reason.
Well, Chuck, there's another thing I want to point out with this, because this is the one that stretches belief beyond its rational parameters. This association, the National Christmas Tree Association, who's been fighting to get government to levy a tax, a fee, on their product so that they can create a slush fund, says, and I quote, "The fee is not expected to have any impact on the final price consumers pay for their Christmas tree." Now, are you telling me that the association is saying, you know what, we couldn't come together as an association and just put aside some of the monies we're making off Christmas trees to create our own advertising fund? We had to come to the Department of Agriculture and the federal government, ask them to do it through a tax, a mandatory tax. But it's not going to affect the consumers because we're not going to pass on the price of the tax to them. Passing on the price of the tax, which we know full well every producer passes on those fees and regulations to the end consumer in the price, if they are not going to do that or they don't expect that to happen, why couldn't they have just created this marketing campaign or funded these research organizations out themselves? Why involve the federal government?
Well, there are a lot of reasons for that, and that is, first of all, the Christmas tree marketers know full well that, A, their membership doesn't want to pay the fee.
Exactly.
And so in order to play the game with regulators, and you and I both know this gets done in every industry that has regulations, what they do is they go to the government and said, we will prop up your control of our industry. We'll help you maintain your regulatory control of our industry, and we'll even go along with some things if you raise this money for us and give us back some of it. Now, you and I both know, if they raise $2 million, how much is the Christmas tree industry going to get back?
Oh, tens if not hundreds of millions of dollars. If 15 cents a tree will raise $2 million. I haven't sat here and done the math yet, but I will while you're talking.
How much of that money? Let's say that the actual amount raised is $2 million. How much of that money will actually make it back to the industry?
Probably about 40 to 45% of it, maybe.
I think that's extremely high. I can't remember anybody who basically did a corporate welfare program where a tax or a fee was involved that basically ran at above anywhere from a 25 to 30% efficiency rate. In other words, 70 to 75% of the money goes into the bureaucracy to distribute the money.
Now, Chuck, let me just give people the numbers here. At 15 cents per tree tax, and this is supposed to generate $2 million, you would have to sell 13,340,000 trees.
That's not out of the realm of possibility.
It's not out of the realm of possibility. But think about it. If this industry right now is selling 13 million trees, and let's say it's even at an average cost, and I know I'm being low on this, of $50 a tree, that's $65 million in profit. Well, in income. We don't know if it's all profit or not.
Probably, we don't know profit.
Because, you know, they
right.
have to go and they have to buy the land or raise the trees and then cut them down and pay the workers. So let's even say, okay, so $65 million. Are you telling me that they couldn't come up with $2 million out of $65 million to market their own industry and help increase their sales? That sounds like an industry that's basically looking for protection.
Well, essentially, it sounds to me like not everybody is. Now, here's the real sticker. Not everybody is a member of the Christmas Tree Marketing Association.
Well, that's
so
true.
So that
well.
Means that, this okay, the Marketing the Association... The Marketing Association would come out and impose a voluntary fee on its membership. But the fact is, not everybody's going to be a member. So basically, what they want to do is they want to attach it as a fee so that they can get non-members to pay fairly alongside members and confiscate that 15 cents tax per tree from non-members. In order to sweeten the deal, now you and I both know that people who have had this 15 cents per tree confiscated that aren't members of the Christmas Tree Marketing Association aren't going to get a sniff of the money.
Well, of course not. Of course not, because it would only be for the association's purposes, since they're the ones who want the fee. But it looks like, again, the ludicrous nature of a tax on Christmas has caught, and as you mentioned earlier, probably the black eye that it was going to be giving the Obama administration right before a major election has caused the Department of Agriculture to be a little bit more circumspect, shall we say. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the fee has not gone away. It's been put into law. It's just a question of enforcement. Now, what really should happen is that some of our congressmen, and I think Senator Jim DeMint was quoted as saying it was the single stupidest tax of all time. Well, I'm sorry.
I don't know about Jim. That.
Your grasp of history is a little soft in that respect. This was a pretty stupid tax, but it's not the single stupidest tax of all time. But the point is,
I have to take you to task for a minute. I have to take you to task just for you said it's in law.
Ah, yes, you're right. Thank you very much. I slipped. Oh, yes. And because it's not a law if it doesn't follow the Constitution. But the Constitution...
Well, it's also not a law if Congress didn't pass it and the president didn't sign it. It's also not a law.
Yeah, but what happened was it was buried in another spending measure, and then the Department of Agriculture was promulgating rules off of what was passed in statute.
And there you go. It's administrative law, which means it's not law at all.
Exactly. You're right. And I thank you for that that check on my shorthand thinking there, because you're right. It's not a law, and it should not be. And obviously, what would happen is if the Congress would rise up and say, "Nope, we're not going to do that. You can't do that. You cannot pass a rule of any sort to levy taxes on Christmas trees." And so there you go. Now, the point is that, you know, Chuck, I mean, most people, because it's winter and it's evergreens, I can hear the cry from some of the folks, well, what about those of us who like maples or persimmon trees or whatever, and we want to make those our Christmas trees? Or what happens if it's, well, you know what, you guys are just supporting a Christian approach to this, because it's only the Christian church who celebrates Christmas. You know, why is that not being... discriminatory toward the Jewish faith, toward atheists, toward Hindus or Buddhists. I mean, what do we got here? I can see that happening as a rationale for why we just need to tax all trees of any sort that people buy for any purpose.
Well, there you go, thinking like a bureaucrat again.
Exactly. And ladies and gentlemen,
you and I both know,
it's one of those things.
You and I both know that's the way it'll work.
It's one of those things that after you get done doing that, you have to kind of go and take a bath and wash it because you feel dirty after you put on the mind of a bureaucrat.
You and I both know that's exactly what will happen.
Oh, absolutely. It's just, it opens the door for further and further involvement and insinuation of the federal government's control over all areas. We're going to start with Christmas trees. If it's a Christmas tree industry, then the roasted ham industry is going to want their piece, and the cranberry industry is going to want their piece, and the wrapping paper industry is going to want their piece, and the bow making industry should have support too, because hey, it's all about Christmas, right? And again, it's just larger and larger expansion of federal governmental control over all of our lives. Now, yeah. Chuck, I hate to say it, but even that isn't nearly as bad as some of the other interesting things that the federal government and our officials have been doing. Because, you know, as you and I have laughed about on occasion here just recently, and this came out last week, and it's the Department of Agriculture again. Boy, I'll tell you what, this is an interesting department. They decided to change the laws of botany. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, that's right. Your federal government thinks that they can change the physical laws of nature. What am I talking about? How many folks out there would, in their probably less lucid moments, ever dream that we would consider tomato sauce as a vegetable for purposes of filling the four basic food groups? But yes, your Department of Agriculture has decided that they are going to say that 2 tablespoons of tomato sauce counts as a serving of vegetables. Now, why are they doing this, Chuck? Because of the proposed school lunch standards that were proposed earlier this year. The spending bill that the Obama administration was pushing, the temporary spending bill, to keep the government afloat, obviously, had part of the Agriculture Department's school lunch standards in it. And what they were trying to do was we're going to try to make kids healthier, and so we're going to limit the use of potatoes and delaying or having limits on sodium and boosting whole grains. But what happened was they've delayed the limits on sodium. So obviously it's okay to have lots of salt as a child. And they're going to delay the requirements to boost whole grain components into the lunch menu. So it's okay to, have those empty carbs. But the bill, the spending bill also has a provision in there that would allow tomato paste on pizzas to be counted as a vegetable. the whole point is that, the frozen pizza industry probably loves this idea, because then, we're not looking at pizza as a culprit anymore, even though it's made with basically, empty white flour and heavy fat and oil cheeses and greasy meats. It's a vegetable serving because it's got 2 tablespoons of tomato sauce on it.
Well, there are major problems with this, as we are both well aware.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, it gets right into this whole idea of the federal government through their administrative agencies, and then through passing a spending measure. So Congress gets involved in this, of picking winners and losers, because, well, what happens to the rest of the vegetable industry when it's easy for the schools to say, we're just going to buy, we're going to have frozen pizzas on the menu three times a week, and that's going to help us to meet those minimum standards for the 4 food groups, because that gets one of our servings of vegetables off the way. What happens to the carrot industry or the celery industry or any of those industries who are going to be the losers? Because we all know that if a child has a choice between a slice of pizza or some carrot sticks and some celery sticks, which one are they going to pick? Which one of the schools going to pick in order to make the kids happy?
Hate to tell you this, I'm 54 years old. If I get offered pizza or celery and carrot sticks, guess which one I pick.
Well, since your wife's not in the room, I'm going to say you pick pizza.
Yeah. Well, guess what? She picks pizza too.
Exactly. But basically, the food companies that produce the pizzas, the salt industry, and potato growers all requested the changes. Now, again, like I said, they stayed the regulations on limiting potatoes and limiting salt, but they didn't stay the whole idea of making tomato, continuing now. I say making. Chuck, this has been in the Federal Register. It has been the standard for years now for school lunches that, yes, you can count 2 tablespoons of tomato sauce as a serving of vegetables in order to get so that pizza can stay on the menu.
Well, if you'll recall, this came up during the Reagan administration, and the Reagan administration was pilloried because it was counting ketchup as a vegetable.
Yes, which again is the same idea here. But now they're looking at tomato. Well, actually, it's not even tomato sauce. It's on those frozen ones. It's tomato paste.
Right.
And honestly, if you think about tomato paste, when you condense tomatoes and make tomato paste, yeah. You've got the whole entity in there, and so when you spread it onto a piece of flatbread to make a pizza, so you've got tomato on there. It's not like it's a tomato substitute that they're trying to count. But basically what they're doing is they figure that when there's groups out there, of course the health groups, that say, well, children are getting too many pizzas and too many potatoes, et cetera. But you don't hear the schools – and many of these industries saying, well, we want you to stop doing that because pizza is a big portion of the school lunch program. And you think how many schools just here in Ohio with 613 school districts, how many thousands of schools that have to feed children 5 days a week, lunchtime every day. And if they all do pizza once a week, that's a lot of frozen pizzas, Chuck.
That's right. And it's a real boon to the frozen pizza industry now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's a major boon to the frozen pizza industry. Now, one of the things that what had happened is that, the reason why the pizza industry is involved in this was because the original proposal coming from the USDA and the Department of Agriculture, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, they wanted to count a half a cup of tomato paste as a serving of vegetable. And obviously no frozen pizza that's an institutional one or a commercial one that you're going to be serving in schools is going to end up having half a cup of tomato paste on it. Now, is it?
Not hardly.
So they really back these rules to say 2 tablespoons. Now, I'm not a home ec major. I don't know how many tablespoons are in a half a cup, but I know it's a lot more than 2. So...
Well, you think about this, an extra large pizza, let's say a 16-inch pizza, yeah, basically has less than a cup of tomato sauce.
Okay, yeah.
Because all you have to do is go down to the pizzeria and watch the guy make the pizza in front of you. He takes out the ladle and he puts it on, he rolls out the dough, puts the ladle on there, and you watch how little tomato sauce actually goes onto the pizza.
Yeah.
Because, as we all know, if you get a pizza with too much tomato sauce, where is it? Most of the tomato sauce ends up on the front of your shirt.
Yes, it does. Having been there and done that once or twice in my life, yes, it does. But
yeah,
but that's the whole thing. We're not even talking about tomato sauce. We're talking about tomato paste, which is more highly concentrated, which you basically would spoon on there with a knife or a spreader across this frozen piece of bread, and then throw some cheese and little chips of pepperoni or whatever that meat is that they put on those. And then throw it in a microwave or stick it in the oven on a cookie sheet and then serve it up to the kiddies. And that's a serving of vegetables for them. But these are the things that our lawmakers are sitting there wrangling over. Do we make it a half cup or 2 tablespoons to say that these kids got their serving of vegetables so we can meet the federal requirements? You know what's really ludicrous about that, Chuck?
Well, I don't know if are we talking about the question of whether a tomato is a vegetable or not?
That's exactly what we're talking about. Ladies and gentlemen, if you've been following this, you have to, hopefully, when I said they're changing the laws of botany, a tomato is a fruit. It is not a vegetable. So in order to say, they're changing the laws of botany in Congress by saying that, hey, we're going to count tomato paste, which is made from tomatoes, which are fruits, as a vegetable. Now, you know, and I'll get into the fine details of what the main difference is. I think the main difference between a fruit and a vegetable is a fruit has its seeds on the inside, and a vegetable would have its seeds outside.
There's more to it than that. It has to do with fiber content and how what kinds of acids are in the, you know, the acid content of the fruit. And those kinds of things, but yeah,
leave it. Tomatoes. Leave it talking to someone who has a graduate degree in this area.
I have an undergraduate degree
in this area. Yes, but we just for purposes of just our simple conversation here, the basic difference is a fruit seeds on the inside, vegetable doesn't have seeds on the inside, and tomatoes are fruits. They're not vegetables, so. I wonder if anybody ever pointed this out, because you've had groups such as the United States Department of Agriculture, the American Frozen Food Institute. There's another one of those special interest groups. Let's see who else has been weighing in on this.
Groucho, Harpo, and Chico never sat down and actually worked this out before they came up with this regulation. Now, again, I'm making reference to a comedy team, but the fact is this is error compounded. This is sort of like the further out you go, the goofier this thing gets.
Exactly. It does. Well, and it's sad too, Chuck, because these regulations, the school lunch proposal was based on recommendations by the Institute of Medicine, the health arm of the National Academy of Sciences. Now, you know, I didn't know. See, I just mentioned that you have a degree in this area. Your colleagues in the National Academy of Sciences, there's not enough of them in there to realize that a tomato is not a vegetable. That's what gets the nutrition advocates from the Center for Science and the Public Interest as well are saying.
Oh, gosh.
Their proposed changes will keep schools from serving a wider array of vegetables. So in other words,
There's never once been a coherent thought that came out of the Center for Science and the Public Interest, not once. This doesn't shock me.
Absolutely. Well, but the point is that, you know, if we're going to try to attack the lack of nutrition in school lunches, maybe we ought to start by being honest about, okay, if we say that they need so many servings of vegetables, let's not try to change the laws of botany by classifying tomatoes as a vegetable. It just isn't so, as the old saying goes.
It isn't
what they don't know. It's what they do know that just isn't so that is the big problem. That's the big problem.
Our good friend Michael Perutka always used that. It's not what you know. It's what you know that just ain't
that's
so.
That's exactly right. So anyhow, you know, ladies and gentlemen, that's the reason why when you read these headlines, read into them. Read deeper into them and look and find out, because your elected officials are passing measures. This was in a spending bill. And honestly, if somebody would just taken 5 minutes and said, whoa, you know what? We got a real problem here because, well, on the basis, a tomato is not a vegetable. So, yes, but you can count it as a fruit. So I guess it falls into the fruits and vegetables category. So for purposes of the school, you could probably count it as one chit. But let's count it for what it is. We count it as fruit, not as a vegetable. Now, that's just my being a stickler for it. I understand. But again, you know, we've got people out there basically saying we can call pizza a vegetable because it's got tomato sauce on it or tomato paste in this. Only from your federal government could this kind of thing come. That's the reason why we're calling today's program Federal Follies, ladies and gentlemen.
But this is what happens when you begin to develop the attitude amongst the population that if the federal government says it, it can't be wrong. Now, I actually heard something today on a local radio station, an interview with a guy who I've heard before, and he's always his big thing is about regulation. It's something like grocery shopper, grocery guru, or something .com. Of course, he's got a website.
Sure.
Well, what's he come out with? This big thing about heritage turkeys.
Okay.
And I didn't I didn't completely understand the concept. It has something to do with the way the turkeys are raised or something. Sure. So, but he said, and his big thing was, there's no federal regulation of this, so no one knows what heritage turkeys actually means. And I said, and you really think that getting the federal and government involved will make you know what a heritage turkey is? You should see the debacle that they've made of the label organic.
Oh, absolutely.
There are something like 7 levels of organic, and they each have different requirements. It's really absurd.
Well, I see that. Now, like, I can understand that, because if you think the word organic has 7 letters, so that's a level for each letter in the word.
So we're if you're doing an acronym, then we're okay.
Then we're okay, yeah.
Well, in our off time, we'll have to sit around and see if we can come up with one that fits the words organic. And I'm sure it'll be ironic if we manage to do that.
Uh-huh. Hey, I got a better idea.
But the fact
how about
is,
our listeners do it? Hey, you come up with an acronym that shows the federal government's involvement in the organic food industry using the letters of the word organic, and send it to us on email at principledpolicy.com. You can send it to director at principledpolicy.com or vice chairman at principledpolicy.com. And, you know, Chuck, the best one, and we'll leave this open for a couple of weeks, but the one that comes up with the best acronym that reflects the absurdity of the federal government in relation to our food supply, I think we should give them a nice resource out of the Principled Policy catalog.
The grab bag.
The grab bag, sure. That's right.
I think that's a great idea.
So contact us.
There's our contact.
Drop us an email at principledpolicy.com, or excuse me, go to our website at principledpolicy.com and log on to our comments section and tell us, but we have to have your full name and contact information in order for us, if you're the winner, to be able to send you your prize. So make sure you put that in the body of your email or on the comment you leave on our website.
Yeah, don't assume because we get your email that we actually know who you are.
That's right. We need your full contact information. So thank you. So anyhow, you were saying about 7 levels of organic.
And this is just one of the absurdities that comes up when the federal government gets involved in some of these labeling issues. Yes, there were people who were claiming organic in the past that meant that they were putting organic chemicals on there. And as an organic, someone who survived organic chemistry in college, the things that term has a wide variety of meanings. Most chemicals that would be put on things for fertilizers and those kind of things are organic chemicals, but that's not what organic means. It means that natural product was used to cow droppings and horse droppings and those kinds of things, and bring in certain insects to eat other insects that may be infesting your crop. And there are all kinds of different ways, no pesticides, no artificial fertilizers beyond the natural fertilizers, those kinds of things. And you'd be amazed at the things people used to say were organic. Now, has the federal government really fixed that? No, not really. What they've done is they've created a situation where certain people who let the Department of Agriculture come out and do quote-unquote inspections, they voluntarily go through inspections, in other words, searches without warrants on their property, get to use the organic label. Everybody else is not allowed on that property, whether they grow organically or not. This is what happens. You basically, little by little, turn your liberty over. Now, there's the usual problem here is that people refuse to police themselves, and therefore the federal government thinks they have to do it. Well, there's no reason why state departments of agriculture and county extension bureaus couldn't very easily. They know who's growing organically truly and who isn't. There's no reason why it couldn't be done at the state level, but no, we got to turn it over to the federal government, where we get this Keystone Cops routine. All of a sudden, they start releasing regulations that say fruits or vegetables. It's absurd.
See, I wouldn't mind so bad if they wanted to categorize tomato paste or sauce or whatever as a serving of fruit and vegetables, because it is a fruit. But to say that it's a vegetable and they're saying, well, we have to have more vegetables in the children's diets, which that's what they're really trying to get at here. And to say that,
which is not a bad thing,
which is not necessarily a bad thing, considering the fact that I remember growing up in schools. I mean, the closest thing you got to a fresh vegetable was canned corn. But now, you know, and it's the ludicrousness of calling a garden salad a chopped up some iceberg lettuce and maybe one or two little micro strips of carrot in it, and that's called a garden salad for school lunches. I don't think so.
One thing I would interject here, sure, though, is think about when the school year is. Mm-hmm. It's fall, yes, till spring.
That's right.
Well, not too many fresh vegetables, at least not domestically grown, and some in California and Arizona and Texas and Florida might make it through the winter, South Texas. But the fact is we have to import fresh vegetables, mm-hmm, during a lot of that period. Now, of course, in the fall, everything is available. It's harvest season. But in the spring, that's planting. Yeah. You know, you're going to get green peas, green beans, and corn, as you know, or hash, as they,
sure,
used to call,
absolutely,
it.
Sure, absolutely. Well, and that
succotash.
And there's,
yeah,
definitely no problem with that. It's just okay. If we're going to do this, first of all, let's not do the sophistry of calling frozen pizza a vegetable. And secondly, let's not try to change the laws of botany and biology by calling a tomato a vegetable, because it's not. It's a fruit.
Yes.
Okay, now, you know what? There was one group, other than us, Chuck, there is one group out there who did see some of the ludicrousness in this, because there was a group that criticized the bill over this particular issue called Mission Readiness. I guess it's a group of retired generals and admirals, the national group, and their director basically said, "We are outraged that Congress is seriously considering language that would effectively categorize pizza as a vegetable in the school lunch program." And this was Amy Dawson Taggart, who's the director of the group, said, "It doesn't take an advanced degree in nutrition to call this a national disgrace." And I got to agree with Ms. Taggart on this, because if the Center for Science and the Public Interest and the National Academy of Sciences couldn't quite figure out the basis of this, that is, okay, first of all, calling a piece of vegetable is stupid, and secondly, calling tomatoes a vegetable is challenging the scientific basis of the classification of it. I'm not sure. I'm glad at least there's some voices other than just you and I here on the radio trying to point out the absolute absurdity of when you start legislating and regulating and trying to micromanage, you end up usually getting yourselves in a lot of trouble, or getting everybody else in the trouble, as it may be.
Well, absolutely. And the fact is, we're not out here by ourselves. We don't get much voice in the mainstream media, which is why we're on a little radio station in Rushville, Ohio. But the fact is, there are more people like you and me and a lot of the listeners out there than people know. And so that's why we get out here and make our little podcasts and our little broadcast on the local radio station. And there's hundreds of guys like out there like us, sort of pointing these things out. If you think you're isolated, you're not.
Oh, no, I don't. And if our listeners think they're isolated, they're not either. But what it takes is a lot of us basically setting the example by speaking out, by writing our letters to our congressman and say, are you seriously considering trying to make tomatoes a vegetable, or tomato or pizza a vegetable? You know, where's the common sense that we hope? And I know I am wishing for a lot. The common sense that we hope that our elected officials would show when they're served up these kind of menus by the administration and the agencies, that they would take a moment to look at this and say, you know, before we make a national laughingstock out of ourselves, let's back up here a little bit and try to do something right.
Well, I'd be willing to bet that this popped up in either an omnibus spending bill or an omnibus farm
bill. It was in the spending continuation bill, Chuck. This was what?
Oh, there you go.
This was there.
Okay,
yes.
Well, which nobody read.
Right.
Nobody read that. It was all thrown together. The thing's gigantic. It's, you know, umpty 11,000 pages. Nobody's read, mm-hmm, that. And the fact is that basically that's how pork barrel spending gets done. Higher ups in committee throw stuff in, say, you know, vote for this. They basically order the people on the committee to vote for it. And everybody wants to keep their committee position or be in line to take over the committee someday when the chairman isn't there. So the people, especially of the same party, vote for it. They don't know what's in there. And that's the problem. These omnibus bills that nobody knows what's in them. You know, I still have to marvel that Nancy Pelosi lost her job as Speaker of the House over this, but you have to pass the health care bill before you can know what's in it.
Well, that seems to be our standard mode of operation in Congress now, is you know, let's, who cares about the details? We just got to get the overarching theme is what carries us through the day.
And on both sides of the aisle, depending on who's in power, this is what passes for good governance. This is one of the problems we have. A, the federal government has grown way beyond its boundaries. And as that happens, we've only got 535 people working on these things. Now, that sounds like a lot, but it really isn't. And so what happens is, as the work increases, as these guys look more and more and more at things they really have no business dealing with, there's more and more and more work to be done, and you get contentious things in committees, and you get splits in the among the populace, among special interest groups and groups that represent guys like you and me.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is that these guys are being torn apart, and most of them are working on things they have no business working on, like the regulation and defining things like pizza as a vegetable.
Yeah, that's...
They have no business.
They have no business doing that.
That's right. This is so far outside of the realm of their constitutional duties. I mean, what they should be doing is taking a look at it and said, we're not even touching this thing. Don't even bring it to committee. Or a committee chairman should look at it and say, okay, this thing's tabled. We're not going to look at it. But that's not happening.
No, of course not, because that would actually harken back to a thing called local control. And where local parents working through their local officials in the school board would decide what the lunch menus were going to look like for the kids in their school district. And they would decide. I think if you got a group of parents in the room together and they really started thinking about it, they'd realize pizza is not a vegetable.
Yeah.
And if they really wanted their children to have high quality, nutritious meals, that would be what the school district would be providing. And it would not be pizza 2 to 3 times a week.
No, unless you threw in true fresh fruit and a vegetable on top. You know, pizza's not a bad food. As long as we could disagree on the meat that you would use on it. But, you know, I know you don't like certain kinds. I'm a pepperoni fan, and I'm also a sausage fan. You and I could probably never eat pizza together.
Oh, I don't know. I could probably, you know.
You could choke it down. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I could do that.
but the fact is, you can make pizza a pretty healthy food. But it doesn't have a vegetable serving in it. It's got dairy, and it's got meat, and it's got grain, but it certainly doesn't have vegetable in it, and it doesn't have much fruit in it.
No, 2 tablespoons is not a lot of fruit. That's the whole case. So, all right. Well, you know what? There is one thing that we do still need to talk about, and it's a little bit more serious, and I wish we had more time to discuss it today. But when it gets right down to it, what we have is our federal government getting involved in something. Well, okay, I can understand in one. Well, maybe I should back up on that. Okay, this happened here in Ohio, Chuck, here just last week, okay? But what happened here just today, well, actually, this happened on Wednesday. The Federal Bureau of Investigation went to Burgholz, Ohio. Now, for those of you folks who don't know, Burgholz is up in Amish country, up in Holmes County. The Federal Bureau of Investigation made a raid on the, as it's reported in the media, the compound of a breakaway Amish group. Now, that harkens back to things with Branch Davidians and Waco and Randy Weaver and all those other things. It's funny how when the FBI does something, they always paint it in pictures of, you know, this group
horribly
dangerous. What they did,
compounds break away. Aren't all Amish by virtue of their theology? Aren't they all breakaway?
Aren't
groups?
They all breakaway and in their own compounds? Mostly yes, but. So Wednesday morning, they came in and they arrested 7 men in this Amish, quote-unquote, breakaway community on federal hate crime charges. Why? Because of attacks that these men had made on other in the Amish community, other men, where they were actually going and cutting the beards of these other Amish men. Now, we're getting into a lot of religious particulars with the Amish community with this, about the growing of hair. You know, and supposedly after a man's married, he's not supposed to touch his beard, he's not supposed to cut it, things of that nature. You know, external law-based restrictions. Well, this separatist group had decided they didn't like what the local bishop was telling them to do and decided to form their own sect. And, of course, they've had tension between the sects. And so some of the people, I guess it was the three sons of the man who was the breakaway leader by the name of, let me pull his name up here if I can find it here real quick, Sam Mullett. Here it is. So Sam Mullett, three of his sons and some of their friends decided that they were going to go out and get a little retribution for the way they've been treated. And so what they would do is they would, you know, grab Amish men and take a pair of scissors and cut their beards. Now, Chuck, you and I know that's a crime. You know, that's physically, that's assault.
Sure, it's assault.
That's assault, okay? That should be handled by the local law enforcement. That should be handled by the Holmes County Sheriff. That should be handled by, if the local community there has a local police department, those all should be handled there. But now what we've done is we've brought the FBI in, and they are going, and they're supposed to be holding they were supposed to be holding a press conference late Wednesday afternoon, but I don't have any information on what they said in the press conference as to why they brought hate crimes charges. Now, I know that some of us are going to say, well, you know, maybe that's a good use of the hate crimes law. But the point is that that is not a good use whatsoever, because what it's doing is saying that when someone has a disagreement with somebody else over their religion and it, you know, gets into fisticuffs, well, that's immediately a hate crime because it's your thought. You know, hate crimes, as you know, Chuck, are thought crime basis. So
yes,
instead of punishing actions, you're punishing intentions. Now, a crime is a crime is a crime. The assault with restraint, if they really wanted to go down to it, they could probably get them for kidnapping, because holding somebody back from being able to freely move is considered kidnapping in some
jurisdictions. Well, having served as the foreman of a jury, I can assure you that that is the case, because if you hold someone in an area and refuse to let them leave, that is the definition of
kidnapping. That is the definition of kidnapping. And to physically put your hands on another person in order to do some form of bodily harm to them is the definition of assault. And these men took and they cut the beards of other Amish men in their community over an internal dispute over this thing. Now, normally, when the Amish have disagreements or legal disagreements, they usually refuse to go to the law. They usually they take care of it within their own community. That's part of their separatist identity of not getting involved in the government. But this did was the FBI jumped in there and now have arrested these people for hate crimes. Now, Chuck, I think we're going to keep an eye on this to see how this thing pans out as it goes. But I think it's a chilling precedent, and it's a federal folly for the FBI to jump in there in an area where, first of all, this is a local matter that the county sheriff should have been handling. And I can't understand why the county sheriff in Holmes County didn't have the ability to arrest these men and hold them for assault against their neighbors. Where's the rule of law going to?
Well, the fact is that the federal government or the state government or the local governments have no business delving into crimes of the heart. That is a sin issue that is supposed to be being dealt with by the final judge, not the judge here on earth. The fact is that the federal government has set themselves up as the arbiter of what you're supposed to feel in your heart. And yes, probably what's gone on here is that the local government is having trouble getting the local Amish community to cooperate in the prosecution of these men because they are separatist.
Right.
They want to have as little contact with the law and with the outside world as possible. Okay, fine. The fact is you can compel people to testify and that kind of thing, but bringing the federal government in, suddenly it's going to make it all better and we're going to make it a hate crime. But there is no such thing as a hate crime. All crimes are of violence have at their core malice. I can't walk into a bar and get drunk and smash somebody in the mouth if I love them dearly.
Oh, exactly.
At that moment, I hate them. And the fact is that suddenly converting a simple assault into a federal felony is not going to make it go away. What it does is it creates a tyranny.
Absolutely. Now, I've always challenged people when they talk about hate crimes to say, well, describe to me what a love crime is.
Yes.
Just to push the irony of the matter that far.
I have heard certain crimes referred to as love crimes. Of course, they're actually lust crimes. And thus we show that we how badly our society has mixed up those two things.
Absolutely.
But there is no such thing as a hate crime.
No, absolutely not. And on that note, Chuck, I think we're just about out of time. So for this Saturday edition, so join us on Monday beginning at 5:30 for our weekday edition of Principles and Policies, where we discuss more of these issues, look into some federal and state policies, and help to look at these things from a fully biblical worldview. Thank you for joining us today. We hope that you have a blessed weekend, that you are worshiping at a Bible-believing church this weekend, and that you will, as every day, live before the face of God. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll see you on Monday.